CBS News Brief. President Trump says he signed off on CIA action in Venezuela to fight drug smuggling by sea and will also stop them by land. But Dan Herman with the Center for American Progress says
many are quite concerned that the administration is operating outside the law, that these strikes so far have been an illegal abuse of wartime powers, and some sort of CIA activity would be a dangerous escalation.
The Supreme Court hears arguments in a case that could remove provisions of the Voting Rights Act that favor minority voters. Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson.
It may be the end of the Voting Rights Act era, but exactly how it ends is unclear.
More U.S. adults would be deemed obese under a new definition. Study author Dr. Lindsay Foreman.
The new definition is essentially capturing this new group of people, the anthropometric-only obesity, who don't have an elevated BMI but do have an elevated waist circumference, or people that have, you know, belly fat.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Hey, join me, Dan Haney, weekday mornings for All News All Morning from 6 until 9 on 540 WAUK on 100.3 FM.
The Crew loses game two. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewer Bats shut down again, losing to the Dodgers 5-1 in the National League Championship Series. On Monday night, Milwaukee lost 2-1. Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
Yeah, if I would have told you that the Dodgers are going to score 7 runs in 2 games and what was the outcome in the first 2 games, I'd say there's a chance we won one of them for sure.
The Dodgers starter, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, gave up a home run to Jackson Chourio on the very first pitch of the game and then became the first player in 8 years to pitch an entire game in the postseason. Dodgers manager Dave Roberts.
You know, you give up the first pitch of the game, you give up a homer, and then you go out there and then you throw a complete game, was in complete command the entire night.
So the Dodgers go up 2-0 in the best of 7. Game 3 tomorrow night in Los Angeles. NBA. The Bucks losing to the Thunder last night, 116-112. They finished the preseason with a record of 3-1. The Bucks season opener a week from tonight when they host the Washington Wizards. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Hey, it's Dan Haney. Join me weekday mornings between 6 and 9 as 540 WAUK presents All News All Morning. We start the day with everything you need to feel informed. Stuart J. Waddles has Milwaukee and local news 3 times an hour, followed by Leslie Lotto from the Civic Media State News Desk, CBS News, Mike Clemens in sports, traffic and weather, money and market updates. Start your morning drive with All News All Morning on 540 WAUK on 100.3 FM.
Real news, great conversation from Milwaukee and beyond. 540 WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Should be no surprise to anyone that you've got young Republican leaders who aren't just towing the line. They're picking up the mantle and they're running with, well, with it all hanging out. Saying the quiet parts out loud, well, to each other. Especially when they think no one's watching. Interesting report over at Politico. They reported on the fact that they found thousands of leaked messages that expose a cesspool of racism, anti-Semitism, and, well, violent hatred that just spills freely from these so-called young leaders. And understand, this isn't just some rogue group acting outside of the party. These are the future leaders of the grand old party. They've made, well, race hatred their stock in trade for decades. Understand, we've known who they are. And what's truly shocking, what's truly shocking, is that there's anyone who's surprised. Anyone shocked by this. Given the Republicans' long, long history, stained with racism, xenophobia, and the dog whistles that escalate open hostility, are we surprised? The words on the page, quite shocking, and I'm not going to go through them. I'm not going to repeat them. But talking about gas chambers and tortures and every racial slur and epithet, everything you could mess, fantasizing about destroying their political enemies. Now understand, this is post-Charlie Kirk, where everything's supposed to, this is bad. And what we see written is, well, ugly. The darkest impulses that aren't being hidden. And the reality is they're being cultivated. When the political atmosphere, as it has, loosens up under Trump's reign, what do we get? This kind of venom that's allowed to fester and spread, infecting, well, even the young. And understand, these aren't just jokes behind closed doors. When a party's young leaders talk about creating philosophical and psychological torture methods, bullying, and making people jump, it becomes a blueprint for the political hate and violence that, well, they talk about. This kind of rhetoric doesn't just stay private. It shapes public policy. It normalizes political violence, and it terrorizes communities, which is the point. This is a chilling reminder that for many, many of my Republican activists, winning means silencing and destroying anyone not in their narrow-minded camp. The silence or weak condensation that we see from the establishment Republicans, deafening. And understand, by failing to fully expel or discipline these toxic voices, they're giving permission to carry on with the same ugly traditions that has built the grand old party and has fractured this country. And for working class folks and everyday Americans, this isn't abstract political drama. It's a dangerous sign that we're heading to deeper troubles, deeper into a culture war full of, really fueled by hatred, lies, betrayal of democratic values. When you get these young Republicans caught, they aren't outliers. They just got caught this time. They are a reflection of what's being cultivated and what's being rewarded. Thomas Friedman was on Bill Maher the other night. And he said, while discussing social media platforms and this kind of hyper-partisanship that fuels misinformation and outrage, he said, and accurately, said it's now a giant industry to make people stupid and angry. Uh-huh. And you've got Van Jones who followed that up by going, look, you got neighbors who, because one looked for a truck and one looked for a yoga mat, are now in different algorithmic realities. Understand, this country deserves to know who these people are and hold them accountable. Because what we're seeing is a threat to civility, humanity, and it's working people who are caught in the crossfire. You know, the things that our mothers taught us about respect and being trustworthy and treating others with dignity, all that stuff is out the window. And because sadly, in too many cases, mom's just as bad, if not worse, out there wearing the grab me by the you-know-what shirts. And this is one of these things that's been bugging me for a while, because understand, the government shutdown is because Democrats don't trust Republicans. Because they're not trustworthy. And that is hard to say. Because I know a lot of Republican voters. I know people who I think highly of who vote for these people. And I know I'm going to get a lot of flack for it, but I know a lot of people that politics isn't the center of our universe. And that they are good, decent people on the surface. I just argue that they're over misinformed by this giant industry that is about making people angry and stupid. Not stupid. Let's go with over misinformed. Or living in a different algorithmic reality. And until we come back to talking to each other and respecting each other and being able to trust one another, I don't see much hope for us going forward. And that's hard to say. The only hope I have is that we find that common ground. And I've said for years, if we want to reunite this country, we've got to reunionize it. We've got to bring people back to some commonality. Better wages, hours, conditions, health, and retirement security. It's a good start. It gets us back together. Because right now, it's every man for himself or every woman for themselves or every child saying the worst horrible things finding their little niche and dividing this country even further. Do I take any joy in seeing the young people, the future leaders of this country, fed the kind of ugly stuff that are in this social media, Telegraph, I think it was? No, there's no joy in this. Breaks my heart. I have hope in the young people. I have hope in a generation that views opportunity and change as possible. But what this shows me as adults, as leaders, someone has failed them. Society has failed them. A political system run by, well, ideologues and hate mongers have failed them. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Randy Corgan is going to be here from Teamsters 1932 to talk about what's going on with federal workers. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day that President George H.W. Bush signed the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. Worker safety at the Nevada nuclear test site had been sacrificed during the Cold War era, as the United States rushed to keep pace with the Soviet Union's nuclear arsenal. The result was an increase in cancers, including leukemia, from workers being exposed to deadly radiation. For more than a decade, these workers tried to get Congress to pass legislation for compensation for radiation sickness. Uranium miners from states including Nevada, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Wyoming also joined the effort, filing a suit against the government. The courts ruled against the workers, ruling that national security needs trumped the safety of workers. Democratic Representative Wayne Owens from Utah sponsored a bill to give the workers compensation. In a statement carried by the New York Times, Representative Owens called the bill, quote, an apology to those people and their heirs on behalf of the government and the American people that were subjected and sacrificed for the Cold War nuclear weapons. President Bush explained the scope of the act at the signing ceremony, saying, quote, the bill provides compassionate payments to persons with specified diseases who fear that their health was harmed because of the fallout from atmospheric atomic testing at the Nevada test site. Regardless of whether causation can be scientifically established, the bill entitles each person meeting specific criteria to a payment of $50,000. Uranium miners meeting separate criteria will be entitled to compassionate payments in the amount of $100,000. The bill established a $100 million fund for the workers and residents who lived downwind of the Nevada test site.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, I love organizations that keep corporate America in check, or at least keep an eye on how bad they're screwing over workers and how bad they're going after you, me, and the rest of us. My next guest, his organization, Good Jobs First, their 10th anniversary of documenting corporate misconduct, things like wage theft and safety hazards, you know, little things that workers don't really pay attention to until it's too late. These are the folks who've been tracking this now for a decade and here to share some thoughts on, well, the study and the history and maybe where we go forward. I've asked my good friend Greg Leroy to come share some thoughts. Greg is the executive director of Good Jobs First. You can check out their website, goodjobsfirst.org. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be with you, Rick.
And congratulations. Congrats on 10 years. 10 years it's kind of a big deal.
Well, thanks. And I want to share the congratulations with Phil Matera, who's really the mastermind of our Violation Tracker regulatory database. It's been a lifelong passion for him. Chronicling corporate misconduct and corporate crime. And we birthed this database, Violation Tracker, 10 years ago this month. And it's got a huge user base now. We're very happy with it.
Yeah, and look, you're the guys who keep an eye on who's ripping us off because, as you know, as everyone knows, wage theft seems to be add up all of the stick-em-up crimes, bank robberies, gas station jobs, all of that, wage theft dwarfs that by multiples, and yet never really gets the headlines of the newspaper.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick. In fact, you know, I was at a recent conference in Chicago, the National Alliance for Fair Contracting, and we were addressed by labor commissioners from several states who are making an issue of this, pointing out that, yeah, wage theft dwarfs other forms of crime in many ways in many states. And yet the penalties are not sufficient. The enforcement is very spotty. Violation Tracker captures all the records we have from both the Federal Wage and Hour Division of the U.S. Department of Labor, as well as state labor departments. And you can see the recidivists. You can see who are the child labor abusers. You can see patterns of misconduct. And it's obviously not just contractors, although that's a problem. And it's not just restaurants and fast food chains, although that's certainly a problem. But it's also even the high tech companies abusing workers on the high tech visas, for example, and banks and other big insurance companies and so on that have had issues on employment and wage theft. So it's a chronic problem across a lot of different parts of corporate America.
Yeah, and you guys have been doing this a long time, have built an enormous database. Have you noticed anything about the repeat offenders and covered anything about them, any patterns, anything that might help the rest of us hold them accountable?
That's a good question. I think that certainly there we did track, for example, the surge in child labor that flared up several years ago when there were those exposés about kids, working all night in meatpacking plants and auto parts plants in Alabama and the Midwest and places like that. And we documented that. We also have race and sex discrimination cases. We have contract fraud cases. I'm not sure there's a pattern over time, except the one big pattern, which no one will be surprised about, and that is a big plunge in enforcement at both OSHA and now also in the Wage and Hour Division since the new Trump administration came in January.
Well, the first Trump administration, the woman who was in charge of investigating wage theft, herself accused of, you guessed it, wage theft.
How can you make this stuff up?
You can't. And the thing is, this is bad, here at home. This is an international problem, and you guys are going global with your violation tracker.
Yeah, so we launched a violation tracker in the UK 4 years ago, and then last fall we issued something called Violation Tracker Global, and you can see them all easily from the front page of our website. The Violation Tracker Global covers 60 countries now, including every nation in the EU, but lots of countries in the global south, in Brazil and Argentina and several other Latin American countries, several countries in Africa and Asia as well, many of the Commonwealth countries. So, and we cover multinational companies only in that database, but obviously that's where the big numbers are and where the big violators are.
And the reality is you're talking a big number of violations you guys have tracked. Did I see the number right somewhere, like $1 trillion in violations that you've checked? I mean, it's obscene when you stop and think about it, but those are things that, workers got screwed out of.
We have $1 trillion worth of penalties captured. It dates back to the year 2000. So it captures almost 25 years of data now. And, banks stand out very negatively. If as a group, as an industry group, banks rank at the top in all three of our violation trackers. Obviously people knew about the bank's role in the subprime crisis and the Great Recession here, but man, it's everything.
Yeah.
It's investor fraud. It's consumer fraud. It's labor, interest rate fraud. They just can't give it up.
No, any way that they can get into our pockets and take it from ours and put it into theirs, they're going to do. And this is where I keep saying I think government has a role, an absolute enforcement role, to one, hold them accountable, but two, punish wage theft in a way that these people don't get future contracts. If you break labor law, if you break wage and hour laws, sorry, no contracts for you. At least I think that should be how it is.
No, so for example, the state of New Jersey's Department of Labor has a thing that calls the WALL. I forget exactly what the acronym stands for, but it's not hard to find. And it's a list of every company that has outstanding wage theft claims or tax payment claims, workers' comp claims, UI tax payment claims. And those companies are not eligible to contract with the state of New Jersey. We think that's exactly right. San Diego County uses our data as a dashboard and says, if you're a restaurant with outstanding wage claims, we can pull your license. If you're a contractor with wage theft claims, we can stop the construction of a building at the drywall stage until you resolve those claims. Brad Lander, the comptroller of the city of New York, has a dashboard headed the same way, using our data on wage theft and other kinds of labor violations. We think that's the exactly right thing to do with the, with this information.
No, and this is why, you know, again, politics matters. Who you're putting into positions of power matters. The policies that they're pursuing, why it matters. As you pointed out, this administration, I don't think they really care about the average worker getting ripped off. They care about corporations and corporate America getting their tax breaks, though. I'll tell you that.
It's really true. And, you know, we're the latest example of that is data centers, for example, which automatically qualify in many states now for sales tax exemptions when they build these things and when they equip them. And obviously they're extremely capital intensive. They can cost billions of dollars. So it's real money. 10 states already lose more than $100 million a year to data center sales tax losses. Texas and Virginia are in the billion-dollar range already.
That is just, again, you know, corporate America gets what they want. And everyone else be damned, you know, food for children, health care for people. Never mind, because we can't afford that, Greg. Yeah. And look, you know, this is where I've said for years, sound investment, smart policy is what we should be focusing on. And you guys have another study you've just come out with, this smart growth and good construction jobs study, that says, you know, urban density, and building high density facilities is good for jobs, it's good for workers, it's good for communities. Walk me through what you found.
Thanks, Rick. And so, you know, we've actually been doing work on this issue for 25 years, dating back to when sprawl became a big issue in the late 90s and early aughts. For the Chicago Federation of Labor, we created the first labor ed curriculum. We said, let's just look at the geography of the major bargaining units affiliated with the Chicago Federation of Labor. Let's look at manufacturing, janitorial, public sector, healthcare, construction, and all across the board, by every measure we could figure out, as jobs thin out geographically, out from this core, you know, part of the Chicago metropolitan area, they deunionize. And, you know, it wasn't, people sort of kind of knew it, but we really had the numbers. It was really demonstrable. And the National AFL-CIO passed a convention resolution denouncing sprawl and urging affiliates to get involved. Obviously, there was also at this time, like, the food and commercial workers were joining a lot of campaigns against Walmart's, and Walmart, obviously, a poster child for sprawl. The Amalgamated Transit Union and TWU and UTU and other unions involved in transit were very big in supporting and defending transit services. But the building trades, everybody, you know, thought, well, they must be agnostic, or maybe they're even pro-sprawl. Maybe they get a lot of work building out there in the boondocks. But if you ask building trades leaders, like the guy I found in Georgia, for example, a plumber who presided over the UA bargaining unit and then the Central Labor Council there in Atlanta, he totally tells the story of, sprawl undermining their density. And Atlanta is the poster child for sprawl in the United States. It's the biggest sprawling metro area. Whereas in Portland, Oregon, the state has had what are called urban growth boundaries or limits on growth that force redevelopment back into the inner city. It's been on the books for more than 50 years there. And the electrician plumber there, who's head of the Building Trades Council for the state, loves urban growth boundaries because he says we have very high density rates rebuilding downtown Portland, rebuilding the Pearl District.
Yeah, and this is one of those things where, you know, Democrats should really be getting behind, because one of the talking points I get from my Republican friends are going, look at these cities, they're all falling down. Look at these cities, there are no jobs there. Yeah, because of exactly what you're saying. All these companies are shipping out of town, looking for, you know, lower wages, less environmental and labor enforcement, you know, less regulation to be able to do whatever they want to whomever they want. And, you know, basically leaving behind, you know, a mess.
It's really true. And, you know, the other measures we use, like looking at construction estimating data side by side for different kinds of housing, looking at highway construction data, you know, rehab and rebuilding of existing highways versus brand new rights of way and cornfields. By every measure, when you build stuff that's more complicated, more vertical, more dense, more mixed use, it's more labor intensive, and it's much more likely to be union because it involves more skilled labor and more union contractors.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it's always made sense to me to fix this idea of fixing what you've got first before you go doing something else. Because again, what you leave behind are problems, these external costs that corporate America never seems to have to pick up. It's us. It's we, the taxpayers. It's the citizens who are left behind in those areas. So for me, it makes perfect sense.
It's really true. And, you know, fix it first is a great agenda, whether it's roads or schools or other forms of public infrastructure. You know, the governor that really pushed this the most was Paris Glendening in the state of Maryland. And he was aghast to discover a very lopsided bias against existing schools in his school capital budget when he took over as governor. I forget what the number was. So it's like, you know, like 10% for existing schools and 90% for new schools. And he said, "That what's that about? You know, we've got all these," and he flipped it basically in his office by saying, we need to maintain and improve, sometimes expand our existing schools, improve quality of life, stabilize those neighborhoods, not disinvest, not thin out. And that was part and parcel of a whole package of bills he put through that's been very successful in Maryland. Maryland was the first state in the country to achieve the 30% conservation set-aside goals that a lot of governors are seeking to gain now.
Through smart policy, yeah. Sound investment. You know, I think what I'm hearing you say is union density is good. You know, our urban density is good. Building in places that have been kind of left behind because it's good for the communities. It's good for the union workers. It's good for, you know, the community to have a reverberation effect of, because we haven't even talked about that. What lessons then can be learned from this study as cities are trying to figure out what they're going to do with their economic development policies?
Well, and that was really an interesting part at the National Alliance for Fair Contracting conference, is what is to be done right now, especially given the federal rollbacks and all the rescissions and attacks on clean energy programs and stuff like that. There was a lot of aching and moaning about that. But people agreed that in places where we have friends in office and where there can be responsible contracting practices, we should be maximizing the value of public contracting, public procurement, and also economic development incentives given to private companies, no matter what they're building, to leverage local hiring, pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship readiness programs, you know, things that favor unionized labor management structures and maximize local hiring and practice and unionization rates.
Now, we've talked a lot about the union jobs that come out of this. And look, as a union guy myself, I am very pro-union. I think every job should be a union job. But especially in the building trades, we know there is a skills gap between the union worker and the non-union worker, where, you know, the value that a union worker brings is far superior. This makes good economic policy from a policymaker standpoint, no?
There's so much evidence now. That was actually part of the sidebar meeting, too. You know, there's a large body of evidence now that project labor agreements, labor management systems for apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs deliver value. They get projects in on time and on budget. They recruit more women, more people of color into the trades. They retain them, they place them and keep them. They graduate them and place them at higher rates than the ABC crowd. There's every reason from a community development, you know, bang for the buck point of view to go union in construction.
And the reason I bring this up and why I think this is so important and the work that you guys do is so important is I look at the current administration, because for me, everything comes back to politics. Because, you know, look, politics is about who gets what. And what we as working people have been getting for the last 40, at least my entire working life, is the short end of almost every stick. So when I see an opportunity to say, hey, there's a better way of doing something, maybe we should consider it. That's why I reach out to folks like you who come up, who study this stuff and come forth and say, look, this is where we should be going.
Well, I appreciate that, Rick. I mean, you know, we think there is really is a high road to be had here. It's and consumers and students and users of economic development should not be pitted against those who create the built environment.
I'm right there with you, Greg. As always, I appreciate the work you guys do. Congratulations on the 10-year tracker. I hope folks will make sure they take a look at that. Maybe look up their own companies, right?
Absolutely. It's easy and free online. Violationtracker.org at goodjobsfirst.org.
Let me ask you, I was going to let you go, but anybody reach out to you and say, hey, you know, I checked your tracker and my company's ripping people off. And, oh, hey, by the way, I realize they're ripping me off. Ever, you got one of those stories?
We hear from people, yeah, doing all kinds of interesting research. We've actually learned, we didn't know, for example, that a lot of shareholder accountability campaigns have been using Violation Tracker, because when you get to corporate governance issues, you know, companies are kind of equal opportunity villains, right? We discover if they're screwing workers, they might be screwing their lenders or their shareholders or their suppliers or all of the above. There's a cluster of behavior that tends to, you know, corporate cultures are not selective about who they screw, frankly.
No, that makes perfect sense. But again, congrats. Good on you. And as always, I appreciate the time.
All right. Thanks, Greg. Great to be with you.
Thanks so much, our good friend Greg LeRoy. I want to make sure you check out their website, goodjobsfirst.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You ever had a job that maybe someone didn't pay you what you were supposed to get? And what'd you do about it? Want to hear about it? rick@therickssmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation, 540 WAUK.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Milwaukee's home for the Todd Allball Show, weekday afternoons from 2 to 4.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy for tonight, a low in the low 50s, and partly sunny as we look into tomorrow, highs in the mid-60s. There could be a shower or two around Friday, mostly cloudy but warmer and a touch breezy. Highs climb to the low 70s. Right now it's 53.
This is Robert Pilot, host of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we talk about Native issues like treaties, protecting Mother Earth, and holding our elected officials accountable. You'll also hear from Turtle Island voices like Arvina Martin, State Representative Heather Keeler, Ruth Anna Buffalo, Dr. Anthony Stately, State Senator Mary Kunish, Robert Lilligren, and Bob Blake. Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, not a day goes by that I don't have someone email me going, hey, I'm sure you notice, because you talk about it all the time, the attack on federal workers and the trickle-down effect that's happening to public sector workers across the country. The question I get most often is, what's going on? Who's fighting back? What's labor doing? And, well, how can we help? And here to share some thoughts on all of those questions and more, I've asked my good friend Randy Corrigan to come share some thoughts with me. Randy is the principal officer and secretary treasurer there at Teamsters Local 1932 out in the Inland Empire. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Rick. Always enjoy being on the show and always love your show.
So I get this this question all the time. We see the attacks happening in the public sector. We see the assault, the ongoing assault on federal workers right now. What are you guys doing?
Well, before I get into what we're doing, I want to first point out some things. Number one is, don't allow this moment to be, well, those are federal workers. Those are them. They're not me. And as long as the attack is not on me, I'm just going to, you know, kind of sit on the sidelines. I think that's a huge mistake. The private sector has benefited from the public sector being unionized for a long period of time. And with collective bargaining being canceled by this current administration, by the Trump administration, that's a dangerous sign for all of collective bargaining all across the country. Anytime rights are stripped away from workers, you got to raise the flag and you've got to say, hey, the alarm bells are dinging here and it's time we do something about it. And to get into quickly some of the things we're doing, we're educating our members and we're telling them exactly how they can mobilize, what they can do to educate their family members, what they can do to educate their neighbors, and what they can do to actually engage in this process to either pass policy to protect themselves more, but also engage themselves in the political process to prevent more of this from happening. Because I doubt most of the people that work in the public sector who may have voted for this current administration realized that this was going to happen, even though we warned them to read Project 2025. This is spelled out in Project 2025. And when labor unions are called a national threat or threat to national security, and when there's a straight up calling out to demonize us and put us out of business, You know, I personally believe that the 16,000 members we represent around here have every right to be represented and have every right to have a collective bargaining agreement. Because, you know, these employers didn't improve these conditions on their own. They didn't create retiree medical. They didn't create affordable health care. They didn't open up that space. Collective bargaining did.
Right.
And so I can get on a long list of things that we need to do and that we are doing. I just wanted to kind of throw all that at you to start, Rick.
No, the reality is your wheelhouse is Amazon. You have spent an awful lot of time trying to organize the workers, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But the fact that you have this company that they make like $36 billion in profit last year alone, and you think about this company wildly profitable, and the kind of resources and the kind of pushback that they're putting to their workers wanting to organize for better wages, hours, and conditions. You think of all of what they're putting into this, and you go, it should be simple. The workers go, if they're putting up this big a fight, maybe I should want this. But I don't know that message is really getting through, is it?
Well, it is in some ways. In other ways, it's not. Corporate America is in control of this country right now. Corporate America is running down the tracks and basically ignoring whatever rules they want to ignore, using everything to their advantage. And they're in full motion to implement Project 2025. And I think people have to take some time and actually put themselves in that space, read Project 2025, recognize how labor unions are villainized in this space. And it's important for us to, you know, make sure that our local legislators do something about it. Kind of like what we saw happen in New York City. You saw New York City itself pass an ordinance. You saw the state of California pass something. You saw the state of New York pass something. So there are things that are happening to push back. I know I'm talking about private sector, but guess what? The public sector and the private sector jobs, these aren't separate industries. These are working people that deserve and have the right to be represented, and nobody should be canceling their collective bargaining agreements.
What was the Knights of Labor's frame? You know, a concern of one is a concern of all, which turned into an injury to one being an injury to all. What happens when you have nearly a million people injured? What does that then mean?
Yeah, almost a million workers have lost their collective bargaining rights in a very short period of time. That is a huge red flag. And one of the reasons I'm on this show today is to encourage workers who are in the private sector to not fall into this trap of saying, oh, well, those are federal employees. They're lazy. They're this, they're that. Well, guess what? If they're your uncle, they're your neighbor, they're your friend, they're your family member, you're actually going to see the work that they do every day. And I get these calls from people saying, oh, I'm glad DOGE did what they did. But guess what? I'm not getting that check because I'm going to work for a private employer but has government contracts, and I'm not getting that check. These things that are happening are actually impacting every single living room. It's just people haven't figured it out.
No, there's a reverberation effect, and it all does. This is the stuff that does trickle down, the kind of pain and chaos that this administration, look, this is what they ran on. They told us what they were going to do, and they're doing it. What's weird to me is people are surprised by it, Randy.
And they shouldn't be. The fact is the private sector threw down in the 1950s and 60s so that the public sector could have collective bargaining rights. And so now the public sector's collective bargaining rights are under attack. And as much as private sector unions have kind of ducked away from engaging in that fight, they've still lost union density. So guess what? You better get in the fight. It's important for all of us to work together, because if their rights can be taken away in that industry, the rights in this industry or the rights in that industry, yep, that means yours will be on the chopping block someday.
But what do you say to the argument that, you know, back when that happened, back in the 60s, you know, labor represented, what, 35% of the workforce, had much more muscular political clout, and now, what is it, about 6% of the private sector workforce is unionized?
Yeah, it's under 6% now, and it continues to keep shrinking, even with workers wanting to be represented, even with 70% of workers wanting to be organized. The systems have broken down because workers have not been connected to the most powerful tool, which is to be able to shut it down, their ability to withhold labor. If we get out there and we encourage more workers to withhold their labor, whether it's with Amazon or even their public entity, some will say, oh, as a public entity, you're not allowed to withhold your labor. Well, what do you got to lose if somebody's taking away your rights? If somebody's stripping away your collective bargaining rights, They say, oh, well, I still have my job for now, because once they take away your right to be represented, then you're going to slowly lose your job. And then through attrition, guess what? You're not going to be around when it's all over.
And in what condition?
Draw the line in the sand. Go to your local, to your city council meeting, go to your county supervisors, get into this space and start to make sure that you have policy in your particular area that protects you as workers, whether you're public or private sector. Yeah, the rules are going to be slightly different, but at the end of the day, it's time we all protect one another.
So let me ask you the straight question, because the reality is what it sounds like I'm hearing from you is a general strike. At some point, the only power workers have is the right to fold their arms and march their feet. Is this what we're calling for? Have we gotten to this point yet? Or do you see a point where that happens?
I think it does. I think that it's not just where they fold their arms and they march together. It's actually withholding their labor. I think if enough people in a particular city or a particular area actually just walked off the job, abandoned their space, much like what happened in San Francisco in the 1930s, where workers, all working people, business owners, everybody supported one another and abandoned the city, and nothing worked. No commerce, nothing was moving because everybody is working people banded together and supported one another. That then spread, which then forced these big corporations, the corporations at the time, and we got to speak it in today's terms, where companies today are going to have to come to the table. Look, we just witnessed it with Disney, with Jimmy Kimmel, right? Because so many people withheld, started to cancel their subscriptions, their stock started to tank fast. Guess what? All of a sudden, it's like that situation didn't happen. He's back on the air, Sinclair, Nextar, everybody's all of a sudden going, yeah, get him back on the air. That's collective action. That's people moving in the same direction. That's people doing direct action, and that's people either withholding their labor or withholding their money.
This is what our grandparents' generation understood, and I would argue that the reason they understood it is they came out of the Depression, they lived through the Depression, there was mass pain and suffering. I've argued, as you have, I just don't think we've gotten to the point where people are, the old labor frame, your head gets right when your stomach gets empty. I don't think stomachs are empty yet.
Well, maybe people that have got a good union job, their stomachs aren't empty enough yet. But when you see a million workers at Amazon, or you see millions of other workers that are working out there in similar industries where their stomachs are empty, where they go to the doctor and they think they have good health care, and all of a sudden they get hit with a $5,000 medical bill. When they got this job, they thought they had good health care, and now they're getting hit with a medical bill. They don't have a retirement vehicle. All these things have been stripped away slowly. There's definitely a lot of hungry people out there. And unfortunately, maybe some of our members aren't in that bucket yet, but that bucket is soon to come, especially the way you see these things happening at the federal level. These funding streams that are shutting down, like I have members that are losing their jobs right now because those funding streams are not going the way they used to go. So as a result, these workers, just to simplify it all, not say it's this department, I'm getting into the politics of it. The reality is when you do those cuts, just whimsically slashing things, all of a sudden, very important programs that communities need, workers whom we actually have multiple people that voted for this administration and turn around are now out of a job, and we're getting them located somewhere else because the funding for their department is gone.
But this goes back to what I was just saying a minute ago. It's now made their stomachs empty. It affects them directly. And this is where, we agree on the end. I just don't know that we're there yet. And I fear we have to go, what I said on election night, and I've been saying ever since, the solutions to our problems are going to come out of the suffering due to their savagery. We are witnessing their savagery. It just hasn't trickled, I don't think, down fast enough. It's coming. You go into a lot of red states where the Medicaid funding cuts haven't really hit home yet. The Affordable Care Act, the subsidies that are being stripped away hasn't really hit home yet. I fear that when that finally does, a lot of people are going to suffer. But my hope is what you're talking about. People are going to come back to the middle of the street instead of yelling at each other on the sidewalks.
Yeah, hopefully, first of all, I want to believe that people are going to identify these issues before the suffering happens. Look, it's smarter for people to cut off a problem before it gets there. I get it. Maybe, a lot of people in today's day wait until it actually lands on their kitchen table. But once that happens, hopefully what happens is through this education process is that instead of workers fighting each other and trying to steal each other's money from one another, which is what we got to teach each other in labor right now. We have to teach each other in labor is don't celebrate what's going on with these workers at the federal government. Matter of fact, empathize with them and help them, because at some point, if it does land on your kitchen table, you as two workers shouldn't be fighting over the same scraps. It's corporate America that's running an agenda down our throat, as it's clearly been pointed out in Project 2025.
No, you look, an injury to one is an injury to all. If it's happening to your neighbor, it's eventually going to land at your doorstep. Something we used to know, and I think every generation does, like solidarity, does have to learn again. But, you know, Amazon to me is a big part of this, because Amazon's the behemoth in the room. They've got a lot of connections, a lot of power, you know, $36 billion in profit, and yet some of the most deplorable working conditions in the warehouse industry. What did I see? The number was like 80% higher injury rates than the rest of the logistics industry, which is crazy when you stop and think about it. And this is, I don't think enough people realize how bad it's gotten. And I think we all suffer in silence. I think we should be screaming at the top of our lungs how bad this is.
Well, and again, that's why I came on the show, Rick, is I'm trying to get people to understand, don't wait until your job turns into an Amazon job. Recognize that that job is out there and that a million people are working under these really, really bad conditions in an industry you and I know both very well that we have been in for more than three decades. We have watched people buy homes, you know, be very, very productive in their community, be able to buy goods and service in a particular area. The model in which these corporations like Amazon, and obviously they're not the only one, there's a bunch of them in this space where they want to exploit workers, takes us back to slavery. It takes us back to where labor forces were disposable, where, oh, I don't like it, so I'm just going to toss you out with the trash. That's why this attitude where workers at the federal government feel like they're the enemy. When in America did we ever allow workers to feel like the enemy? The only time we've allowed that is when we had our head up our rear end by allowing slavery in this country. And for us to open these doors and not be empathetic and not recognize this moment, what we're doing is that the inevitable is coming, that we're going to be on the chopping block. When it lands on your kitchen table, you better not point the finger at another worker and fight them. You should be fighting corporate America. Period.
Yeah, back to the old Jay Gould quote, I could pay half the working class to murder the other half. And as I've been saying, they're not even paying anymore. We're sadly doing it to ourselves. For instance, I had an Amazon driver come to the house, and you know, every time when somebody comes by, I never miss an opportunity to talk to them and find out what their conditions are. And of course, say, look, you should be looking at organizing because, you know, wages, hours, conditions, all that stuff. And the response that I've gotten back, oddly enough, is, we've got air conditioning, which is a weird kind of argument to throw back at me.
Well, it's not. As an organizer, one time I had a group of workers that were most compelled by being able to wear shorts. Sometimes, you know, we believe the issues are more important than the workers themselves. And it's really important for us to sit down and understand what is it about your job that you want to change. And they are happy that they have air conditioning. I want to make sure that they have air conditioning. But many of those drivers that are delivering from Amazon that are delivering to someone's doorstep, they didn't work anywhere in the industry. This is their first driving job. So their exposure to the industry itself and exposure to the working conditions, they're just ignorant to them. And so once these workers talk to each other and they actually recognize what the potential is in those jobs, you know what? That shifts really fast. So what I would suggest, that in addition to what you do when you have somebody come to your doorstep, shake their hand, congratulate them, point to the others that they see all over the country holding Amazon accountable. You're wearing an Amazon vest, you have an Amazon van, you're coming out of an Amazon facility. Guess what? Your company, Amazon, says that you don't work for them and you know they have control over your operations. It's time that they are held accountable. Yeah. Every single person, every single driver I've ever talked to in that situation always says, yeah, that's a really good point. So what do you think you should change? Or what do you think would be worth fighting for. And they immediately go into those conditions. Again, most of them, 99% of them, never worked in the industry before.
Yeah, no, I always bring up the wages that are paid at UPS, the conditions that they have, the pension,
they don't believe
the
that,
health
Rick.
Insurance. No, and I use my own story. Look, you know, I've talked on the show this entire year since my wife's accident about how fortunate I am to have Teamster health insurance and how because of that insurance, it's made it possible for me to get through a lot of this stuff. And telling that personal story, people are like, oh, well, I don't really, my insurance isn't, I've got, you know, co-deductibles and co-insurance and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I say, no, none of that. They do what they say they're going to do. It's that security of not just wages, but of job security, of health and retirement security. All this stuff is important. And they do come around to that. But the weirdest thing is, it's the air conditioning. But here, I got to get you, before I let you go, you've said that Amazon's an existential threat to the labor movement, and I would argue probably to the entire work of this country. What's at stake in this moment for your union, for workers, if we don't begin to organize Amazon and take them on, and we don't have law changes that help facilitate that as we've had in the past? What does that mean?
Well, I would argue your frame of reference is wrong. We have begun to organize. These workers are organizing. Thousands of them have organized. Thousands of them have demanded recognition. Thousands of them should be recognized. And Amazon is obligated to bargain on behalf of thousands of them already. So these workers are already pushing back. These workers are already exercising their right to withhold their labor. These workers stole America's attention for 4 days last year, rightfully so, and millions of workers are following. So what's at stake? Well, I think we all know what's at stake. If every company in America operated like Amazon, which is what all the corporations want to do, well, then guess what? Nobody could afford to buy a home anywhere where they're working. If you go to work at Amazon and you work there and get to top scale, tell me a place in this country where you can afford to buy a home. There's no place. You literally can't afford to buy a home anywhere. So if every company had this same model, nobody can afford to buy a home. That's where we're headed. However, what's inspiring is seeing millions of workers follow these Amazon workers, millions of workers. And I'm going to put this together with the public sector. Look, public entities are impacted by Amazon's operations. These operations are super dependent on the services in a particular area. People are on subsidies. They're on government subsidies. Companies like Amazon are paying what they're paying. These workers are having to get their benefits and they're having to get, you know, food and other resources from the government, from the local government, from the federal government. And guess what? That becomes a drain on the economy. It becomes a triple drain on the economy. And so what's at stake? There's a whole lot at stake. But what's inspiring is these workers are actually doing something about it.
There you go. Last word. What's the message to that Amazon driver, that warehouse worker, that truck driver? What do you want them to know?
Congratulations. You're inspiring workers all over this country. We can see that millions of workers are following you. Millions of workers are paying attention to what you're doing, and millions of workers want to do the same thing you do. Shut it down. Make sure you hold them accountable.
There you go. Randy Corgan, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great stuff. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you for having me on, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you do when the Amazon guy comes to your door, or woman? Do you just take the package and or ignore them, or do you take the moment and go, hey, there could be a better way? Want to hear your thoughts? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I gotta tell you, I think Randy is absolutely right, and I've been saying it for a long time. The only way things are going to change in this country is when people find each other in the middle of the streets. We're moving towards a time where the only avenue to save democracy is by, the frame I use is folding your arms and marching your feet. Randy's like, you know, leaving your work. Same thing, just different phraseology. But it's what our grandparents' generation did. It's what our great-grandparents' generation did to build the things that we now take for granted that are all being stripped away. That's the reality of the world that we're in. And when you see nearly a million people in the stroke of a pen lose collective bargaining rights and have a government that is unwilling, unable, and flat out won't protect their rights, there's something wrong with this entire scenario. And the only way that changes when everyone, and I love the fact that he brought up Kimmel, because I said from the beginning, look, this is an exercise of power. This is people realizing that, you know, as consumers, as workers, as voters, we have real power if we choose to use it. Now, it's interesting, chose to use it for Jimmy Kimmel, but not for workers working in one of the most dangerous industries in the country. And this is where, as consumers, we do have real power. You could just not buy something from Amazon for a while. You could choose something else. You could, I don't know, go to the store. Make it a family outing. And the weird thing is sometimes they're not any better. So for us, the power in our pockets is something we haven't used in a very, very long time. My grandparents understood it. They explained it. It's time for another generation to figure this out. And if it means that, you know, maybe things need to get a little uncomfortable, maybe we don't get everything we want the minute we want it, because we're building for a better future, maybe it's time to start talking about that. And I've been saying we need to organize a general strike for a while, just to show Wall Street, corporate America, politicians, that we still can come back together. We can still find each other. Now, have they done a really great job in tearing us apart? Oh, you bet. They have done an amazing job of divide and conquer. But there's still an opportunity here. There's still outrage. And on October 18th, you've got the No Kings rally coming up, which, interestingly enough, watching Republicans kind of run around and frame as anyone who shows up to that, just an extreme leftist who wants the government shut down, I found comical. And understand, they're going to start calling anyone who goes Antifa, because evidently now everything that they don't agree with is Antifa. But it's people. It's working people saying, you know what? We demand better. We, as Americans, we should get better. And it's our government who should be fighting for that. Makes sense to me. Now, the question is what are we going to do about it? I get a lot of emails from people complaining that, you know, this is terrible, the sky's falling. What do? We talk to each other. We organize. We come back to the street. We find a buddy. We get off social media. We get off of texting. We talk to each other. Eye to eye, face to face. That's the way forward. And that's what they're afraid of. No algorithms to put us in the different directions. But actual conversations. want to hear your thought. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
We're a civic media station.
540 WAUK, Jackson, Milwaukee.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro condemns what he calls coup d'etats orchestrated by the CIA. It comes after President Trump confirms he authorized the CIA to conduct covert operations in that country.
President Trump says he issued the authorization for two reasons.
Number one, they have emptied their prisons into the United States of America.
And number two,
drugs. We have a lot of drugs coming in from Venezuela.
The U.S. military has blown up several small boats Trump says were running drugs into the U.S.
We're not going to let this country, our country, be ruined because other people want to drop, as you say, their worst.
When asked if the CIA has the authority to take out Venezuela's president,
wouldn't it be a ridiculous question for me to answer?
Linda Kenyon, CBS News, the White House.
What is said to be one of the most significant airlifts in Alaska history is underway. Hundreds of people are being evacuated from storm-devastated southwestern coastal towns hit by